So our first guest today is going to be Marty Weiner. And somebody was asking me, you know, there's all these characters out there in the Feldenkrais community. Why are you starting with Marty? And the reason is that I personally am curious. So, Marty, I don't remember exactly where I was 10, 12 years ago, if that long. And I got this little brochure in the mail. I think it was called Mentoring Mentors or The Mentor Experience, something like that. And I remember being very curious about doing it, but you know, I had no idea who you were. I hadn't heard your name. I was new to the Feldenkrais community. And then fast forward a number of years, so just a few months ago, at the Feldenkrais Guild of North America's conference in Rhinebeck, had a chance to bump into you, have a brief conversation, and found out that you were one of the first presidents at the Feldenkrais Guild, and saw you interacting with some people, and I thought, all right, I'm going to have to find a way to get this guy online and talk to him a little bit. So I was hoping today we could start off by talking about an article that you wrote last year in the Feldenkrais Journal. Awareness and Functional Integration, does that sound reasonable to you?
Sure.
Okay. My take on it, one theme that emerged out of it for me was this possibility, or maybe it's even a requirement in the Feldenkrais work, of concentrating on working with a unique individual in front of you and respecting that individuality and whatever it might come out of it, rather than, say, categorizing, labeling them into a class or instance of a class and that type of thing. Would you agree with that to an extent?
Yeah, well, I would agree with it totally, that more than to just an extent, I think it's the basis of the kind of work that I do, that treating the situation that you're in as a particularly unique situation, and by connecting with that and with the person that you're with in that situation, seeing what's there and what unfolds, and that if you bring labels into diagnoses and things of that nature from the past, then it really kind of prejudices or taints what you can experience of what's going on in the present. For example, I mean, if somebody comes and they come in with a diagnosis to you and they say that they have been diagnosed by doctors as having multiple sclerosis, and if you feel that multiple sclerosis is something that's beyond your ability, that can't be treated, that's just going to take its course and so on, and that's your belief system because in your head they have a diagnosis and you're going to be treating multiple sclerosis, then you've defined your world in a way that you can't help this person. I mean, you've structured it now that you've made yourself impotent. But if somebody comes to me, you know, if somebody says they have multiple sclerosis, that's fine. I'm not going to deny that or whatever. By deny that, I mean I'm not going to get involved in an argument to say, well, there's no such thing as labels and so on. But what I'm going to look at is the person, experience them, experience their life, feel how they walk and what's possible for them now. Because if you start with a person facing a difficulty, that's something you can put your hands around rather than multiple sclerosis. And people have come to me, it's very interesting, I've had people come to me with diagnoses of multiple sclerosis, and because I don't see that, it's not that I'm because I'm not treating multiple sclerosis, I've actually been able to help them. In both cases, the multiple sclerosis went away.
Well, it's interesting because as you were talking and mentioning sort of the medical diagnosis or the medical label, I was thinking about some of my own experiences where someone came to me and said, oh, I've got thoracic outlet syndrome, and feeling this fear or tension or going, you know, I have no idea what that is. But then when you started to explain how you, say, look at the person, view the person, watching them walk around the room, then it's almost like my experience just kind of opened up a little bit more. Does that make sense?
Right. In other words, when you're there in the situation and realizing that essentially what your role is to bring more consciousness into that to that person and to explore them and help discover them so that their own brain and their own awareness system can begin to appreciate some things about itself or themselves that they didn't realize before. That's a whole different enterprise in trying to make multiples go away or something else go away or treating a syndrome.
And so what about, I mean, the I guess what you're describing I think comes up a lot for practitioners, especially beginning practitioners. You know, you go out there in the world and people come to us very often with a certain mindset. So it's, would you say that, I don't know, I'm just kind of going back in my personal history thinking it was somewhat seductive for me in the beginning, 5 or 10 years ago, to think that, okay, that's their mindset, I've got to sort of deal with that. But you're saying it's almost like the FI could start verbally beforehand to make sure that we're connecting with them in our way and the way that we do things?
No, I would say more that that given their mindset, whatever their mindset is, whatever their world is, I'm going to enter into that world and try to experience it and see how it holds together. And usually I can find some wiggle room within their own world, within their belief system and so on, that allows me some possibilities, to introduce some possibilities into them that they hadn't felt or thought of before. So it's as if my consciousness, my mind, and my capacity to touch and feel what's going on in them is brought into their system as an ally. I remember one person that came to me over, and I've been doing this for 30 years, pretty intensely, like all day long. And all that time, there's only one person, I think, that I said I wouldn't see them again after one session, and that was, and she said, why? Because she wanted to make another appointment. I said, because you're too, there's just no room in you for any kind of movement, even though she kept talking about wanting something. And I said, I'm just not going to take that on. It's a waste of your money and energy and my energy. And she began to cry, and we began to talk, and she began to open up to some possibilities. And ultimately, I did see her again, and she went through some major changes in her life and became a really different, fulfilled person, where she came in really kind of gray and depressed. But there's always, if you enter a person's world as an ally with them inside their world, then there's some possibilities. It's when we try to bring a system from the outside and impose it on them that you run into trouble, where the person is there as an object rather than, it's an object in your world as a practitioner rather than you being available to them in their world. And it gets, if you say, you know, it's seductive when you start off as a practitioner in certain things. I think one of the things that's seductive is the fact usually when somebody comes to me, they're coming into what seems like my world because they're coming to my office. Even though the action is taking place here in my office, I'm very clear that I just entered their world. And if you think of how you feel when you go to see somebody, you've got a problem that you've had for some time, maybe acute, maybe chronic, whatever. It's something that's impacting your life, and you going to somebody because for some reason or another, you heard or read that they might be able to help you. And so what you want is them to enter into your world and really understand you with their expertise and bring that expertise into service and value to you. So when somebody comes through my door, I'm aware that I just entered their world, not vice versa. And that, to me, is a very important thing to keep in mind. And so that I don't try to impose my system on them, I explore them with my hands. I mean, it is my system to the extent that I do more hands-on work than talking, although I do a lot of talking too with some people if I see that's appropriate. And what they need is to kind of come out of the trance that they're in or the mindset that they have. I'm always working with their experience as the kind of fundamental starting point, not my system, because I don't have a system. And that's why I think, you know, when people talk about the Feldenkrais method, there is no method. He was constantly changing. And if there is a method, the method is simply to be constantly changing and growing so that the being that you bring to the situation, to the meeting with another person, is a larger, deeper, wiser being, and that you bring yourself to that person's life to listen and to be of service.
There's a quote from your article that, or I'm making into a quote, I think, and you said, how would you proceed with a client when you are confronted with a brand new, unique situation for which there are no existing categories? And I found that fascinating because, in a sense, it's basically like a choice point, because you can actually, even if you think you know a lot about the situation, you're saying that, you know, you can take that position of forgetting about or suspending my pre-existing categories and, you know, just treat this person as what it is in this interaction.
Yeah, I think that's well said. Moshe, I remember him saying that whenever somebody came to him, all of his information and knowledge was in the background. It was there, but it was not what was in the forefront. It wasn't the way he was looking at the world, but it was there available to him, and he would approach the person brand new. You see, that's what's really kind of exciting about this work, is that you really get a chance to discover something brand new and to be creative and to let the creation come out of your current experience of what is happening in this instant. So from that point of view, it's not a method at all. It's an art form. It's an art form that you're being creative. It just so happens we're creative with our hands, and our medium is the consciousness or the awareness in the body of another person.
And that reminds me of Moshe's idea about joining nervous systems.
Right.
Or creating a new being, so to speak.
Right. You create a brand new... It's like two computers that are now hooked up, and they have much more available to them now is a new organism than either one had separately. And that's what happens when you begin to interact with a person. You essentially become a new organism with four arms and four legs, and you're like... So that... And this is what a lot of people would say is either impossible or, you know, how do you do that and so on. But I really think it's quite possible, and that you share the same experience, each from your own side, but you're meeting in the same experience. It's like when you shake hands with somebody, there's two hands meeting, but you're creating an experience that you each share, and you come away from that experience knowing an awful lot about that other person if you pay attention. I think that's why we shake hands. Instead of sniffing each other, we shake hands, and if your radar is on, you just learn an awful lot about that person if you're open to experiencing their energetic and their offering of that energetic to you in the form of a handshake.
Now, you've talked about the Feldenkrais method, and I've actually heard this a lot, and this is something that David Bereson says quite a bit, you know, about not being a set of techniques. And yet, when I go around and see trainings, and well, I guess what's the relationship between, I say, techniques and learning the method is what I'm getting at. Is there a time when it's?
Yes, yeah. There's to me that one side of that equation doesn't exist, so I can't tell you what the tie-in is. And the side of the equation that doesn't exist is the techniques. And I think David is one of the few people that really gets that.
Mm-hmm.
And think what you're talking about when you go to trainings and other things. People are showing you techniques, what to do with X. And that is, frankly, we never got that in our training with Moshe. I don't think that's what he was teaching.
Mm-hmm.
He never did the same thing to a person. He would look like it's the same thing, but each time he would rediscover it and create it. The point is that if you start to think in terms of techniques, you're now thinking back in terms of labels and diagnoses. And that's the ordinary way we think, and that's the ordinary form of consciousness in our culture. But I think Moshe came along and said, look, I want to wake you up here and get you out of that form of thinking of labels and causality and techniques and so on, and introduce you to a different way of thinking, which is much more vital and present. And that's what he was trying to teach the practitioners. He wasn't trying to teach them a series of techniques that constitute the Feldenkrais method, and he was trying to pass on. He was trying to pass on his own discovery of how to discover yourself.
That's beautiful. I'm just wondering, like, so is there, I had this fantasy once years ago that there would be a way of teaching people just, and see here, I'm about ready to use the Feldenkrais method, but is that really even?
I understand.
Yeah, is it even a useful category?
Well, language, because of the way we think in language, it's very hard to get around those kinds of terms.
Uh-huh. Yeah, but
let's not. So we got to use them, but let's not let them dictate our thinking.
So I guess what I want to know, and I don't know if you can answer this or if there's really an answer out there, would be what would be a better way to train practitioners, or to not maybe even train is not a good word, to open them up to experiences and possibilities. And is that something that you're doing in some of your advanced workshops?
Exactly. That's what I'm trying to do. Then I'm trying to figure out in what I've been spending a lot of past years trying to do, and I realized I wanted to pass on what I know to other people. And how do you do that in some kind of way that doesn't make the way you taught it become what they think they're learning? Mm-hmm. In other words, you have to touch your body. So it's easy to think that the Feldenkrais method is about touching bodies. But I'll tell you, Moshe said in our work, in our training with him, he said, I can teach you what I'm trying to teach you by teaching mathematics. It's just that you'll get a lot more out of it by using the body. Now, if he could teach us the same thing, teaching us mathematics without using tactility as a medium, then clearly it's something he was trying to teach that was beyond teaching somebody the techniques of what to do with a shoulder that isn't moving a certain way.
Mm-hmm.
Okay?
Mm-hmm.
And so how do you teach something? And I think this is the problem with everyone who really develops something on their own, for whom it is a living thing, the master of anything. Because for the second generation, if you haven't really impacted the way they think, they'll co-opt what you're offering them into a standard way of thinking, and they'll make it into a system. So that what Feldenkrais was doing was a living, breathing, constantly changing thing as he did it. He wasn't doing the Feldenkrais method.
Uh-huh.
He was doing it new each time. There was no method for him. He would say the only principle is to have no principle. There's got to be an extension of that into the only method is no method. And so how do you teach somebody something without them getting seduced by the way you're teaching it into thinking that's the teaching? You know, see the old Zen thing where the people talk about, you know, when somebody is pointing to the moon,
and
you know, someone's looking at your hand rather than the moon.
Exactly.
Well, I think if you're trying to indicate what does the act of pointing out something mean, then rather than, you may want to be pointing to the moon to indicate the act of pointing, but you want the person looking at your hand rather than the moon. It's only when you're pointing beyond the moment that you look outside of it. And so, what you're trying to do is teach people how not to look outside the moment, but how to stay present with what's happening and help it unfold. And how you do that, to me, is the question. How do you teach somebody to be creative, to be an artist in what they're doing? And I think it's doable. I'm working with some people now in an intense way, and we're trying to explore that. They're very conscious folks. And I think there's ways of doing it. I think there's ways in which you can get a person to open up their own eyes and really get excited. What happened to me was many years ago, after studying with Moshe, I did a workshop with one of his assistants, and after I did the weekend workshop, it was the first and last workshop I ever did, really.
Mm-hmm.
When I came back to my office on Monday morning, I was less empowered, not more empowered. I felt like there was stuff I was supposed to know that I didn't know, things that I should know how to do that I didn't know how to do, and felt I never learned them from Moshe and so on. And I realized that's the last workshop I do, and instead, I started to pay attention to my own experience. And my experience in teaching, I'm happy to say, is people call me up and they say, you know, I went to my office Monday and it was thrilling. There was stuff that I'd never seen before that I discovered, and they're so excited. So I think it's possible, Ryan, to do it. The problem is, can you set how you do that into concrete and make that a method? You follow?
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think you can do that. I think it's possible to teach somebody in such a way that they get it's not a technique, but I'm not sure how you teach people how to do that yet without making it a technique.
Right, because it seems like that body of knowledge or system or whatever you want to call it is going to change from person to person somewhat.
Right. Exactly. You see, and also, I mean, I think it really helps to realize is that what people are calling a method is the fact that it started with a guy who was having a problem. And nobody could help him, so he decided he's going to figure it out by himself. The process of him figuring it out by himself, working with his body and doing all kinds of bizarre things that he tried out, including staying in bed for an extended period of time so he could not have the feedback of walking in the gravitational field so that he could go back to more like being a child and learning all over again.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he was really out there experimenting. In that process, he learned a tremendous amount. That amount, what he learned and internalized, can't be taught in something that you can write down in a notebook.
Mm-hmm. It was his experience, so...
Right, and
yeah.
What he tried to... See, now, here's what I think Moshe tried to do, and I think there's going to be a lot of disagreement, but I'll say it anyway. That he discovered the value of learning how to explore and play. And he tried to teach us that constantly. And he looked around and he saw that people don't know how to do that. People would be a lot better off walking and moving and so on if they learned something that they once knew, most likely, and forgot, and that is how to play, how to explore, how to become aware, how to take something simple and a movement and begin to become fascinated with it so you see how it moves through your whole body and so on. And he realized people didn't know how to do that. So he did ATM.
Mm-hmm.
And ATM is, rather than it being a way of learning how to move your arm better, what it is directions on how to play.
I like that. I mean, I teach infancy and early childhood development classes at the University of Utah. And, mm-hmm. you know, my basic, you know, epistemology or idea is, you know, everything that we do, we have to had to learn at some point, as far as, you know, rolling over and learning how to stand up. And I mean, we engaged in a huge amount of that. And
right.
So I don't know if it's maybe reminding people to a certain extent or so.
Exactly.
Now, yeah. Go ahead.
Bring them back to a place where they're going to relearn how they learned originally. It's like language training programs that are successful teach a second language the way you learn your first language, by not
yes.
translating.
Mm-hmm.
And they're successful. It's the same thing. If you realize that what you're learning is how to go back to an earlier stage in your life where you were playful and exploring and didn't have all of the conceptual apparatus you have about your limitations and everything else, what would that be like? And I think that's what he's trying to teach us.
Now, you've got, and I'm sorry, I'm forgetting the details. I think your assistant sent me an email. Do you have a training coming up, or an advanced workshop of something? Whereabouts?
I have a three-day, I'm calling a mentor with a master, and I say that humbly. It's one of those alliterations that...
It's good marketing, you know, mentor with a master.
Trying to get people's attention. It's going to be, I'm looking at my calendar, March 23rd, 4th, and 5th, that weekend. And it's pretty much almost full. And I'm going to be doing another one that I'm going to send out a notification, but I don't have the dates yet. But the one in March, it is March 23rd, 24th, and 25th. And it's in Ventura, California. The cost is $450, and there's accommodations, you know, there's a discount for rooms there and so on.
Okay. Well, help me out a little bit, because I was from Northern California. Ventura is where exactly? So where is it in relation to L.A.?
From L.A., it's about an hour and 20 minutes to a half hour north of L.A. on the coast.
Okay, so people would be flying into L.A.?
They can fly into L.A., or they can fly in if it works them from some places into Santa Barbara. From Santa Barbara, it's about 20 miles, 25 miles south.
Okay.
So it's closer.
And if somebody's listening to this for the first time and say they're a new practitioner and they just heard your name for the first time, Marty Weiner or Martin Weiner, how would right. they find you online? What's the best way of doing that? So I noticed you are an artist. So I typed in martinweiner.com and got some lovely sculptures and things that came up.
Right, that's one way to access me, because there's a contact button that you can push and you'll get my email address and you can contact me through that. So you can go either to Martin Weiner, no spaces or anything, weiner.com, and you'll get that, or you can just email directly, or let me give you my phone number and my email. Is that okay?
Yeah, sure.
My phone number is 805-640-6410. And my email is M, like in Marty, Weiner, at sbcglobal.net.
Okay.
sbcglobal.net. And I'm happy to speak to people. Over the years, doing workshops and traveling and so on, I run into practitioners who feel like there is something else, that a potentiality in their work and in themselves that they would like to tap into. And they're, you know, out in the boonies somewhere, or where you're in a big city, and they feel all alone. And I'm very happy for those people to provide some kind of contact and a sense of community that, yeah, there's somebody else maybe of a similar mind. By the way, one of the things you said, if we have just one more minute,
we have plenty of time.
That in terms of teaching people, you know, we were talking about how do you train people so they can get beyond technique.
Mm-hmm.
I think one of the things that you have to really do to do that is to get people to begin to look at themselves to look at the baggage that they're bringing to the situation. Where people think, when they see some master at something, they think that the reason that person is masterful is because they know something. They know certain principles and whatever. And that if they went to that master, that the master could teach them those principles and they would be able to do what the master does. Well, the fact is, what makes a master is that they've internalized something through hard work and learning from themselves that is principled, but they may not know the principles themselves.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas if you take a master flower arranger, he may know impeccably what to do in each situation, but may not be able to state a general principle or rule that you could follow to do the same thing. And it's very interesting. The Japanese invested millions and millions of dollars in a study to try to figure this out, to try to figure out how can we take what masters in any art form know and get to principles or axioms and corollaries or whatever, to make it systematic of what they know so that we can teach it to people. And they abandoned the project because they realized that's not how masters work. It's fascinating.
That's not how they develop their craft.
That's right. They didn't develop their craft. Take a look at how a baby learns, all the complex things that the baby learns.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I'm actually...
It's not because they've got principles that they can, you know, state.
Yeah, they're out there just figuring things out. They're exploring.
Now, you can get some insight into the human nervous system and how that works by watching, you know, babies and seeing how they learn and so on. But still, what the child is doing themselves is a phenomenal feat. And the process, I think, of becoming a master is eating the dinner yourself, not having somebody else eat it, and you writing down what they ate. It's not the same kind of nourishment. And I think for that, you need to be willing to take some risks. One of the things I tell people in workshops is that there's a difference between being a map maker and being a map follower. So, for example, the skills that Lewis and Clark needed in opening up the West to white people and to our way of thinking and so on, that to open up the West, they were never lost when they were wandering around because they had no map. You can only be lost when you have a map. They were making the map. So everything was new for them, and the skills they needed were skills like how not to panic when it's getting dark and you don't see, you know, you can't make a fire, it's raining, how not to get eaten by an animal. Just all kinds of skills that you need when you're out exploring and making the map. But, you know, 200 years or 100 years or whatever, 150 years later, people come along, and we have a map of that area, and we follow the map. It's a different kind of skills.
Mm-hmm. That's a great... Go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, and that I think as a practitioner, once you realize that in some form you have to be Lewis and Clark, and that what you can benefit from is other Lewis and Clarks who are contemporaries or who have preceded you, so you can talk about the exploratory process and growing, and how do you change mindsets in yourself and other people and so on. Rather than learning the, you know, 18 tricks of being more powerful with your clients. You know, there's just a lot of folks who are willing to satisfy that, you know, shortcut urge. I'm not one of them, and I don't think that's where you really get the full benefits. In other words, that's something I said recently on the FLD forum. You got to learn, and he said this, to suck things from your own thumb.
Say that again. You got to learn to do what?
What he said was, I guess it's an expression in some language that he was translating into English. That was my take on it. Because you've got to suck things from your own thumb.
From your own thumb.
Yeah. In other words, if you want nourishment, that at a certain point, you have to let go of the nipple, and you've got to suck it from your own thumb.
Hmm.
In other words, have your own experience. Talk to other people about that and so on. But even then, the kinds of questions that you ask people, I think, you know, says how you're doing your journey.
Well, I tell you what, I'm going to let you go for now, but that's
okay.
Just because we've only been on the phone for 30 minutes, and already I'm either in trance or being pulled out of trance, have a lot to digest, and I'm hoping you will consider talking to me again in 4 or 5 weeks.
I'd be happy to talk to you again. First, I want to know, you're all right.
What's that?
I mean, so now you asked me a bunch of questions. Let me ask you a question.
Okay.
Okay? They can't either be in the interview or not. That's your choice.
Okay.
But as part of the experience we're having together, did something happen to you in the process such that after 30 minutes of talking that you want to stop the interview?
No, I don't think so. I just get the sense that this is a digestible chunk.
Okay.
And I'm a very active walking around kind of person, so I'm kind of walking around my computer right now. And yeah, you know, it's interesting. I'm thinking a lot about my experiences when I first came to the Feldenkrais Method. So a lot of that's bubbling up for me. Because, you know, I was basically, I was a complete wreck. Mm-hmm. I had been homeless for a few months. I was living in my car. I had gotten over a drug addiction and all this crazy stuff. So I was this very, very marginally functioning individual. And I remember, you know, sort of bumping into the Feldenkrais Method. I was in Texas at the time. I moved to Berkeley, took a training with David Barrison and Elizabeth Barringer. And it was just such a deep world. I mean, I'm going through all these changes and learning how to be human and learning how to have emotions and laugh and have a sex life and all that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. And yeah, once I finished my training, I just started moving. You know, there was just so much that I needed to explore. I wanted to explore. So I did a lot of traveling to other countries and got my bachelor's and master's. And at some point, and part of the reason for me doing this podcast is I want to find what else is out there in the Feldenkrais Method.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's exciting. See, you sucked it from your own thumb.
Hmm.
You see, all of that stuff that you described,
mm-hmm.
your history, you can look at it and think about it from the point of view of the downside of that, something you're escaping from, okay?
Mm. Which I don't, by the way.
Yeah, I didn't think you did, but I think, because you don't sound like the kind of person who would do that, but I think that that is a tendency that people have. And what it sounds like you've done is taken all of that, you know, learning to overcome a drug addiction is an unbelievably tremendous training in helping other people. Because in one form or another, a lot of people that are going to walk through your door as a practitioner are addicted to feeling the way they feel. I'll give you an example. One of the first people I worked on was a guy who had gotten shrapnel in his knee from World War II. And he came to, this was now in the end of the 70s at some point.
Mm-hmm.
And so he had the shrapnel in his knee. He couldn't bend his knee. One of his legs was straight. And so at the end of the session, his leg bent at 90 degrees. And I didn't have him. I was working in him. I had a mirror in my office for whatever the reason. Now I don't have a mirror. But in any case, I had him working in such a way he couldn't see his own knee because I knew that his thinking would be such that he's got a history. If I can't bend my knee, so as he's looking at it, it's going to keep from bending it, that his own belief. And so at the very end of the lesson, I had him look in the mirror, and he was shocked that his knee was there bent. He knew something was going on, but he was surprised to see the visual picture with the subjective kinesthetic sensation that he had. And he made another appointment. And it turned out right after that, I had a psychiatrist who was seeing me, and he came to see me, and I was all excited about the session, you know, and I told him about it, and he looked at me, and he says, "Guy isn't going to come back." I said, "What do you mean he's not going to come back?" He's just kind of, he's so excited, and blah, blah, blah. He says, "He's not going to come back." Sure enough, before his appointment, the guy called me up and he canceled the appointment. And I said to this psychiatrist, "How did you know that?" He says, "You changed him too fast."
Huh.
He couldn't live with it.
Mm-hmm.
He had himself, in other words, he was addicted to a way of being and a life with a stiff leg. He got a lot out of it. And he didn't want to give that up. And so your ability to overcome your addiction is tremendous grist for the mill of your own learning in terms of helping other people overcome their addictions to the beliefs and labels that they have about themselves. So that's what I mean by sucking it from your own thumb, taking your own experience and living it in a way that's a learning process for you so that what you bring to your encounters with other people is enriched by that.
Yes, well, strangely enough, I don't think I would not have it any other way. I had some brutal years in my 20s, but the independence and the ability to move and think and be my own person have something that I value.
But listen, you know those years, whatever they were and whatever my years were,
mm-hmm.
we came to right now, we're at the same point, exactly the same point. We're having a conversation on a podcast.
Right.
So whatever the past was, it brought us to the same place. Isn't that, to me, that's fascinating.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, you got here through that pass, and I got here through my pass, so it must have worked.
Right. And you're also bringing me back to the present moment.
Yeah.
Yeah. stay here with me, Ryan.
Pretty much all we have.
Is what you're saying. Okay.
Okay, so I will let you go now, and I look forward to talking to you again. If you want to call me or email me or do whatever.
Yeah, sounds good. And for those listening, remember to look up Martin Weiner on the internet. And, you know, I just thought as we're talking, this will probably be up in about 48 hours. I think someone can just type in Feldenkrais podcast, and this will come up pretty easily. Or type in my name, Ryan Nagy, and it'll be posted online. All right.
Okay. And the other thing about it is there a way that we can make that article available? I'm going to the article available and let them know it's available in this.
Yes. As soon as you do that, I can post it up somewhere so people can have access to it.
Okay. Great.
All right.
All right, Ryan. It was a great pleasure.
Yeah, it was good. Yeah, very much. And I hope we talk in the next couple of months.
Okay. Before that, I hope.
Or sooner. Okay. Cheers.